Okay, great. Thanks, Corey. Actually, I'm going to try to do two things today because Bubal actually raised a number of points, and I want to be able to fill in a little bit of the background for what she was talking about. So I'll try to do that in maybe the first third, and then I want to switch back and talk about how you actually break granular materials. So the part that has to do with impacts and breaking materials was the work of A. Clark, who is now actually at Yale, working with Corey, among others. And it was also part of a larger project where Corey and Wolfgang Loserton and Luke Hondich were involved. So the kinds of questions that I want to ask in that part of the talk is, if I drop something on the beach, how does the granular material respond, and what brings the whatever I dropped, the intruder, to rest? Okay, so that's going to be what I'll talk about in part two. But before I get there, let me just say a little bit about the idea of jamming and shear jamming. So this has to do with materials that have friction. And so here's the flavor of things. Most of you are, let's see, is this a pointer or is that, that looks like a pen. Okay. So most of you are aware, of course, of a paper by Andrea Liu and Sid Nagel from a number of years ago now, where they proposed a jamming diagram where they were thinking, among other things, in the context of particles without friction. So granular particles, but no friction. And the idea is that if you look at the packing fraction and the shear stress of various kinds of packings of particles, there is a lowest packing fraction, phi j, and below that, states are in general unjammed, and above that, states will be jammed, meaning mechanically stable. When we went to look at what happens in materials with friction, we found something that was richer, and so this is actually from a paper by Max B., Bubal Chakraborty, and Jay Zhang. So at any rate, in this regime, there are not only the jammed states above, which are isotropic along this line that were envisioned here, but you can go below that packing fraction that corresponds pretty much to what you would get for frictionless particles. And the point is, in this regime, you can generate a range of different states all at the same packing fraction that can be totally unjammed, that can be sort of marginally jammed in the sense that they're stiff in one direction but fall apart when you push them in another direction, and then states which are really robustly jammed.
And this
is from experimental data, yeah. So that's what I want to show you. Okay, because that was the context for Bubal's talk. And so in this part of the talk, right, in principle, many, many people have collaborated on related work, but the people whom I've highlighted in bold are particularly relevant contributors. Okay. So the other piece of the paper that was roughly contemporaneous with Liu and Nagel was something by Mike Cates and collaborators, where they were thinking of colloidal systems that have been sheared. And the idea is you develop, when you sheared, you develop networks, which in granular materials you would call force chains. But that if you reverse the sense of shear strain, then the rigidity that you had developed to form these networks would vanish. And so they might even be mechanically stable. That starts to become a little bit gray in the context of that paper. But the point is that these systems were rigid only in one direction and not in another direction of shear strain. So we're actually going to be looking outside of the Liu-Nagel box. So this is a diagram where sort of, again, pirated sort of thing. This is inverse packing fraction, so denser systems are at the origin. So we're looking more or less outside of that region. And we're going to take a granular system, a physical, although somewhat, model granular system, and we're going to shear it. Okay, it's going to be a system of photoelastic particles. And so we're actually going to look, in principle, we could look at different brands of shear. And so I'll talk about pure shear as an example where we squeeze our system in one direction, expand it in the other, keeping the density constant. And I'll also talk about what I'll call simple shear, which is perhaps what one more commonly thinks of as shear, where I deform a rectangle into a parallelogram, again keeping the area constant. And in fact, in older measurements, the blue eye measurements, right, we had done couette shear. And all of these systems have a feature of compressing the system in one direction, dilating or expanding it in another, but keeping the area constant, the volume, in 2D. Okay, so just a comment, right? So what I'm going to show you in throughout the experimental piece of this talk, which is 99.9% of it, is photoelastic studies. And so this is a tool where you take materials. They're special. They're specially made for this, but they're typically polymers. And when you subject them to interior shear stresses, then they develop light and dark regions. And so this actually, you know, this was Brewster who discovered the effect of stress birefringence. It was used by people in Japan and France in a semi-quantitative way. But the two points that are relevant here are that in the Blue Eye paper, we first used this as a way to get local forces. And then more recently, this is the work of Trush Majumdar, we then developed a technique so that we could use classical elasticity theory some standard stuff doing photoelastic materials to get contact forces between grains. So that means is we have a complete description of our system, okay, mechanical system, okay. So that we can take an image like this, okay, the photoelastic effect is color dependent, so you have to pick one color, which we pick as green for technical reasons. We can then actually determine by some algorithm that I'm not going to tell you about, but I will in private, what the contact forces are, and so we can then create a fitted diagram. So this is not data. This is, if you like, a reconstruction of what the data should look like by finding the contact forces. Okay, so we now know what's going on in these systems in a very quantitative, detailed way. And so now we're going to take that kind of approach and apply it, first of all, to a system of grains, which we're going to subject to pure shear. So squeeze one way and go back the other way. And so now this is what it looks like. So you're looking down on a layer of these particles. Again, you're going to be squeezing in the vertical direction, expanding in the horizontal. Okay, so let's see what we get. Okay, so the particles are lighting up because they're carrying forces. Okay, you can see force chains here. Okay, I think an interesting discussion would be, what, you know, are there force chains in some of these molecular systems where people focus on STZs, likewise, are there STZs in these granular systems? And I think the answer might be that there are no force chains in the molecular systems, and there are no STZs in the granular systems. But that is a discussion I would love to pursue in more detail. So now we're compressing in the other direction. We're still shearing. We just reversed the direction. Okay. And so at no point has the density changed. But we started from an utterly unjammed state with no stresses. And we'll go back to the original wall configuration. Okay, and so then we end up here. Okay, so it's a little bit like presto change of magic. Okay, we're just sweeping out a series of states in our system, which we get to, okay, by a protocol that involves applying shear. Okay, all right, come, Mr. Gates, please give me back my cursor. Okay, I hate you, Mr. Gates. Okay, here we go. Okay, so we started here. There's basically an unstressed state. We ended here. Okay, so you have a range of states that you can get to. Okay, again, the protocol is shear, but the states have well-defined shear stresses associated with them and other properties. Okay, now there was a technical issue with that system. It developed shear bands. That's great if you want to look at avalanches because you break the system along the shear bands. But if you want to look at homogeneous states, it's not as good. And so we developed a system where we could basically apply an affine strain everywhere in the system. It's a mechanically complicated, but what it does is sort of carries the particles along the whole base of the system rather than just the walls deform in response to the shear strain, which is now simple shear. So now if you look at trajectories of particles, mostly it's affine strain. Okay, so this is the strain direction. Okay, you've moved. Each one of these is a particle position, which is where it ended up after you've sheared the system. Okay, the density also remains, basically homogeneous, and we can do this over many, many, many cycles of shear. Okay, so it always stays, in some sense, homogeneous, but not isotropic, because when you've sheared it, it does exactly what the pure shear experiment does. It becomes extraordinarily jammed, right? So this is a state that's so stiff that if we push it a little bit harder, it will simply pop out. Okay, it's unstable to buckling out of the plane. Okay, so now, so this is, so Jim was talking a lot about ensemble descriptions and generalized temperatures. If you actually look at what happens if I shear and come back, shear and come back, what you see is this state is highly fluctuating in the stresses. Okay, that actually is described by an activated process in a stress ensemble. Okay, the particles, meanwhile, don't go anywhere very much. So if I look, come on, go in. So now I'm looking at the particles, there are little bars on, I can track. Okay, so you can see rotation from cycle to cycle of shear strain. The particles are highly caged, they don't go anywhere. It's the stresses that are fluctuating, and so it's a stress ensemble that describes them. Okay, and for those of you who like to think, oh, well, maybe it's the bottom that all these particles are resting on that is important, this is where we have floated the particles and then sheared them. Okay, actually get a little bit slipperier by doing this, but okay, all right, good, okay. So they do the same thing. Okay, so there's a range over which we can do this, and since my time is going on and I don't want to spend enormously more doing this, the point is you have these anisotropic force networks, they evolve in ways that we can track, and we end up, at the end of the day, okay, with what you just saw, namely a region which falls below where the lowest phi at which, okay, so if you go above that, we always have jammed states. If you go below it, we can get both unjammed and jammed states, at which we generate by shear. So that's where we end up. And that was what Buber was describing. Again, friction of the particles involved. And if I had more time than Corey probably will let me have, okay, I could tell you more about friction. Okay. So the original thing I wanted to tell you about is what happens when I break stuff. And I think that will also be particularly relevant to some of the other talks that I think we'll hear today. So we're simply going to throw something into a bed of grains, and now all sorts of complicated dynamics are going to occur. So we have a sort of a weak solid onto which we're going to drop an intruder. It's going to be granular materials, but it's our photoelastic particles. It's between two vertical sheets. Okay, so we have a bunch of disks. It's a disordered packing. Okay, we have bi-disperse or tri-disperse. Okay, and so now we're going to look at the dynamics of what happens. Yeah, so the fragile are states where you have a network that, so we're calling it, okay, so again, I think we can fight a lot over what that really means, but yeah, so we're thinking of that as where you have a force network that percolates in the compressive direction, but not in the dilation direction of the shear. So then if you reverse the shear, it just goes away. Okay, good. Okay, so I, just for the sake of the record here, a list of people who have worked in the field. I don't want to expand on that. So I just want to show you, you know, this is a cartoon of what we're doing. It looks scarily like a guillotine. Okay, never mind. Okay, and so the idea is there's an intruder. Okay, it's opaque. We track it. We have some holes on it where we can, which we can use for tracking, and as it plows into the material, we're looking at the photoelastic response. Okay, and so we can track photoelastic response, but we can also track the intruder and track the particles, so we know a lot about what's going on. Traditionally, this kind of system has been described in a kind of a very, if you like, a slow time model that says that the intruder, as it penetrates into the material, is described by something where obviously there's gravity, this kind of a static pressure-like term acting on the particle, and then this is a momentum transfer term. Okay, and this is actually the most important term. It actually dates back to a guy named Paul Sillet, who was an engineer. We actually got his book and couldn't find any reference to this, but that's who knows. Okay, so the important consideration here is now just to keep in mind is, granular sound speeds are much lower than the material for the bulk from which the grains are made by, let's say, a factor of 10. And we're also dropping, at the moment, particles in with relatively slow speeds. Okay, so that's what I'm going to show you first. Okay, so if you think in terms of a Mach number, the ratio of the intruder speed to the granular sound speed, okay, this is a very low Mach number experiment, even though, you know, at first sight you might not think so. All right, so here's what happens. This is high-speed video, so we're going at 50-odd thousand frames a second, and then you slow down so you can see it at normal rates. Okay, so the intruder is barely moving, you just see it touches the surface. And what it's doing is it's banging on these on a network which has a, which is more long-lived, okay, than, say, so the network kind of hangs around and it gets excited by impacts with this granular intruder. They tend to be relatively normal impacts, okay. So the grains, of course, have friction, but really you're exciting these pulses more or less along the normal direction. Okay, so that's what we're looking at. And so when you run on the beach, that's roughly what happens, right? So this corresponds to, you know, a few meters per second speed, however much you get by jumping from 2 meters. Okay, so we're going to track the intruder because that's how we can relate to the Poncelet model. Okay, and we're going to also look at the photoelastic response in some region underneath the particle. Okay. All right, so first of all, what is the intruder doing? Okay, so actually, okay, when we track the intruder and compute its acceleration, we get some rather noisy-looking curve. Okay, if you try to fit that to a Poncelet-type model, it would be this dashed red line, right? So the Poncelet model really is a very slow-time model, and the system is doing something on much faster timescales that you don't normally see because something that happens in a quarter of a second is beyond your capability to register. Okay. All right, but, okay, so we would like to come back, though, and look to see how well that model works. And so if you think about it, right, if I plotted the acceleration of my intruder versus its speed square, if I could do that for a bunch of different trajectories, I could work back out the coefficients in this model. Okay, and that's what you do. You drop it at many different speeds. You look at the acceleration at a given depth of your system, okay, versus its speed square at that point. Yes, indeed, it looks pretty much like that model. Okay, so it works pretty well. Okay, now here's something which is kind of amusing. So we have to filter, okay, our measurements of the position of the intruder, okay, and because we're doing tracking that introduces noise, differentiating amplifies that noise. So we filter the actual position measurement of the intruder, and if you filter this rapidly fluctuating photoelastic signal, okay, they actually match up astoundingly well, right? So the photoelastic signal, which is fluctuating much faster, presumably is a measure of the acceleration. Okay. So this is, for instance, a time series of the photoelastic response in some region right below the intruder up here. This is just a space-time representation. So you're kicking off these, it's not very bright. So you have a bunch of these pulses that you're generating in time. They're moving into the material where they decay away. Okay, so in fact, okay, what we think this photoelastic signal is a nice proxy for the actual forces on the system because we're colliding with these force chains that are poking up into the system. So here's the photoelastic signal. Here is the sort of the smoothed response. Here is what we measure with, you know, with effectively filtered response of our system. Okay, so actually what we can do is we can back out the fluctuating term in the forces, right? Okay, so we can determine this amplitude function F2, or I think we call it H later. Okay, so I take the actual photoelastic signal as the proxy for the acceleration of the system, divide it by z square, for instance, what I get is the fluctuations. They're kind of a multiplicative fluctuation because it really does depend on how strong the force is, how big the fluctuations are, right? So basically this looks kind of static once I divide out the z square. Okay. So properties of that fluctuating term, okay, it has a correlation time of milliseconds, right? Okay, and has a distribution which kind of looks like P of F, for instance. Okay. The penetration depth, so this is the log of the intensity of the signal versus depth. So you can see it's falling off in a length scale of 10 particles or so. Okay. All right, so just a quick comment, which is, okay, so this is one way to think about it. Okay, and now there's actually a way that makes it much more elementary looking, and somehow this, well, whatever. So people have not used this before, very much that we know of, but after all, this is the depth derivative of the kinetic energy. That's the kinetic energy. So we can rewrite what is a second order nonlinear equation in z of t into a first order linear equation in k of depth, okay, which means we can do standard sophomore mathematics on it. So you can find the velocity as a function of depth, but so for instance, right, you can also go back and say, oh, guess what? The distance before this thing stops is logarithmic in the incident kinetic energy. Okay, so if you're, okay, I have to remind you that we were supported by this military group, right? So if your goal was to shoot into sand, okay, then you have a shock awaiting you because the distance that the intruder goes before stopping increases logarithmically with the kinetic energy. So if you really want to go really deeper, you have to make it go really faster, and guess what? That will destroy whatever it is you. Never mind. Okay. I didn't say that. Okay. All right. So anyway, no matter though. Okay. So we can go back. We can find, so this is the coefficient of the v squared term, right, that we determine from actual data with different shape objects and so forth. It's roughly constant. There's a little transient right at the beginning of the impact, and then it just fluctuates about. This is the static term. Okay, it's nicely linear, which is sort of what people have generally used. And the stopping depth is remarkably logarithmic-like in the initial kinetic energy. Okay. So now, all right, so why does this model work, right? Okay, that's sort of the, you know, that is the question that immediately pops up. And so we would like to actually see if we can model that term in a very simple-minded way, and then we can provide a test of that model, because what we're proposing is that the stopping just occurs because you're exciting networks kind of locally. Think of those as little clusters. Okay, we keep banging into these clusters, and transferring momentum into them. It's the thing of a cluster of grains, a force chain is literally as a particle, which is crazy, but okay, we'll see it actually works. Okay, and then we can test to see how well the model works. We're basically doing kinetic theory, if you like, for an object which is plowing into a grain of clusters, I mean a gas of clusters. Okay, and we can test how well our model works by changing the shape of the intruder. Okay, and so really, we have like 1 or 2 degrees of freedom to adjust, and then we can look at lots of different shapes. Okay, so, and shape really does matter here, right? So you change this drag coefficient term pretty significantly as you change the shape. Okay, so that's the idea of this. Okay, so we're, again, the important term, by the way, in stopping these things is this z squared term. The static term is just there to keep things from continuing to fall, if you like, and so we're. So here's the idea. You imagine you have a collision which is inelastic with a cluster, okay, and that of course means you've got a force associated with each collision, and so forth. It goes, well, so you get a v squared term, just as you would get if you're looking at collisions from a gas, and it depends now. If you assume that those collisions are primarily normal. Okay, you can compute a force which depends on some shape of the interface of the intruder. Okay, and that's also true. You can also compute a torque because there's nothing that says these intruders have to go straight in. Okay, in fact, they don't go straight in general. They actually will rotate. Okay, so we end up with a functional of the shape of the intruder, which determines other than the v squared term and something that's sort of, if you like, a parameter of your system. Okay, you have a shape form for the force, and you have a shape form for the torque. Okay, and that's all you got. Okay, you don't have much left. Okay, and so now actually for this, it turns out that it really is advantageous to use pointy things with flat faces because the shape thing is very simple to compute. Okay, and so then we're off and running. Okay, there's our children, Abe's children. Okay. He would probably not like that, but never mind, okay. And so then each one of these things is characterized by a slope of the, okay. So actually now what you see is that there's a footnote here, because everywhere along the side you have sort of an equal probability of a collision, but that's not true of the tip. So you have to treat the tip a little bit differently. But at the end of the day, right, what you find is that here's what you find for the tip. You do this by measurement. So here's the tip area, here's the side. Okay, you're off and running. And so then here is the shape factor. Okay, here is this coefficient in front of the v squared term. Okay, so it fits really very nicely. And there's this tip piece. Okay, good. All right. So now we can also do this for various things like disks and things that are this. Well, okay, whatever shape those are, they're called ogives. Okay, which is a vague word for something that looks like a shell. Now, Corey can explain that sometime. Okay. All right. So at any rate, pointy helps you, right? So the stopping power, if you like, of the grinding material falls quickly as you increase the aspect ratio. There's a torque piece that I haven't yet told you anything about, right? But now, if you think about it, right, if you tilt off the vertical axis, you might expect your system to be unstable. And in fact, in general, it will be, depending on where the center of mass is compared to the surface of this thing. So you can compute from this same kind of picture the unstable growth factor with depth. If you go off stable, okay, and in fact, that suggests that the log of the angle, rotation angle of these intruders, okay, will vary linearly with depth if it goes off, right? And so now we can relate the growth factor, the growth rate with depth for these things to our model. At this point, we have no adjustable parameters, right? Okay, and it actually works pretty decently. Okay. So the deal is, right, with minimal input, we can actually get a pretty decent description, not only of the force response, but also the torque response of these systems. Okay, so in the last few minutes, what I'd like to do is tell you what happens if you go faster, right? Okay, so how do you change the physics, if at all? Okay, and I think this will relate to some talks we're going to hear later. Okay, so the basic problem is height. Okay, we're dropping these things into our system. You know, we've got a theorist sitting above us, and he would be annoyed if we drilled a hole in this floor. So we can't actually drop the intruder any faster. Okay, all right. So experimentalists are even more difficult than theorists, so it's okay. So how do you go faster? Okay, well, the answer is you don't. Okay, but what counts is how fast you're going relative to the granular sound speed. So just make your grain softer. Okay, so that's the trick. So what we did now, yes?
I thought you had military funding, could you just shoot
out? It's on a campus, you know. I mean, I need to tell you what happened in the '60s. You know, okay. You know, so the Army Research Office was on the Duke campus. Okay, all right, you got it. All right, so that's why, right? Okay, you can have that discussion offline. So here's what I showed you before. Okay, and these are actually very hard particles. They're about as hard as glass. Okay, they're actually plastic, but they're really very stiff. Okay, so memorize that pattern. Okay, so I know that you're all good at shape recognition. This is now softer. Okay, and so this actually is not. I mean, it still has this networky flavor, but the density of the network is higher. Okay. And then the last one, okay, so this is rather relatively soft material. Okay, and so now what happens is it's so soft, okay, that the front, so the wiggly, the wavy, you know, whatever, the fingery front, okay, actually can't run away fast enough, and the system starts to have a much smoother front. Okay, so there's actually this steady smoothing as we've increased the Mach number. Okay, so this is sort of a set of frames during, you know, similar depths of impact for these hard, medium, and soft systems. And
in this soft case, you already have some.
You have hydrostatic. You can see the hydrostatic forces. It's soft enough, right? And actually, so Karen Daniels and Joyce Kopic, who's now at University of Maryland, did experiments in soft materials And we got these crazy fronts which we didn't understand. So now we understand them, I think. Okay. All right. So now, what controls the propagation down that force network? Okay. Okay. Thank you. Okay. So, well, all right. How about the following, right? You're propagating forces down a chain. Okay. So the people here who are sitting in the corner, people who can tell us how to propagate, okay, or Vincenzo, how you propagate structures down a kind of chain-like structure. And so the idea is, well, you say, okay, the speed roughly will be order of the particle diameter as we send the signal down the chain divided by a collision time, right? So two grains are coming together and separating, and that's a standard calculation. Okay, so you can do this. Everyone in the room can do this. So imagine the particles, so they're not really separated, right? But they're just touching. They compact, and then they separate, they expand again. So you can compute that collision time. It depends on the force response of the particles, which is not linear. We measure that force response separately. Okay. So now, we then can look at this is basically a ratio of velocities, or you can think of it as a ratio of the intruder speed to this estimated speed of the system. And so we can go from Mach numbers of very small to order one. Okay, and again, to actually make it a real speed ratio, there's probably an additional factor of about 4. Okay, so now we track the fronts of our system for, this is hard, medium, soft. These are space-time diagrams, okay? So now this collision time picture would say that the front of our system, if it's moving down this network, the front divided by the bulk sound speed of our system would scale as a number, an exponent, which we know from calibrating our force law. So it's the impact or velocity relative to the bulk material sound speed. So hard, medium, soft, this is the front speed versus the impactor speed. This is the exponent you would expect. And so you just now normalize everything by the front speed, by the bulk speed, and everything collapses. Okay. So it works rather well, except, there's something here. Okay. So what's happening there? Okay. So actually what's happening is the particles are being squeezed so hard in the soft material at the higher end, they're actually, they have a Poisson ratio of order half. They squish out sideways, and the system actually gets harder. Okay, this is also bad news, by the way, if you're trying to shoot through stuff. The system is getting harder as you impact faster. Okay, but we can calibrate that because we just have to take a collection of grains and squeeze them at the relevant stress levels, and so we can actually get the extension up there just by doing that. Okay, and in fact, another way of seeing the fact that you're in getting more and more particles involved in this network is to calculate a participation ratio, so the fraction of the grains that are actually part of the network. And so as you go faster, that participation ratio goes to 1. Okay, so, all right. So I think I've gotten to the end and done some justice to both the shear jamming thing, which I'm glad to respond on questions to, but also if you now look at the impacts, right, what we really see is a clear distinction, which depends on how fast you're going relative to the granulous sound speed. And you can understand this Poncelet model, which goes back to the beginning of time, really in terms of just a collision model, once you know something about what the collisions are like. And so then we can, again, so this all has to do with what the intruder does, but you can also understand what the kind of granular front is doing as well, just in terms of the simple scaling model. So, end of the story. Thank you.
Okay, I'm opening it up for questions.
Just a quick question. I'm confused by your discussion of the military applications. I thought we worked for the it was the Department of Defense. Hmm. So the harder it is to shoot through things, the better the defense.
That's what they might shoot.
Well, Yeah, that too. It's the question is, so you know they're not going to call it the Department of Offense anytime soon. Yes. So sanitizing. Yes. Okay. All right.
Okay. In the middle of your talk, you have discussed the fluctuation of the host acting on the intruder.
Mm-hmm.
And I missed the distribution function of the fluctuation. So is that the Gaussian?
No, it looks more like a gamma function. I mean, it's a P of F.
P of
so
F.
It's more or less exponential fall
exponential.
Off and a linear. I mean, it doesn't. So it falls to a finite value. So it's not simply a gamma function, right?
And only you have showed such data. Did you analyze more detail of the effect of the fluctuation to act on the motion of the intruder?
Let me see if I can go back to that. Sorry, folks. Go back to that. Oh, okay.
Yeah. That's
so yeah. So. Know how much so can you be a little more specific in saying what you wanted to know? So we do know the autocorrelation in the fluctuations, okay, and then of course you can in principle relate that to how far the intruder has moved in a millisecond. So it's going, let's say it's going order of magnitude 10 meters a second,
mm-hmm.
And then in a millisecond, right, it's gone multiple grains.
Okay, thanks.
So it seems like you've gone to Mach numbers of about 1. Do you expect interesting things to happen at significantly higher speeds?
So, of course, the question is what do you mean by the Mach number? And so we have, if you put in the full numerical factor, the real Mach number is probably above 1. Okay, so, but, you know, going faster, so eventually what will happen is you will get to a regime where you break the particles. So something breaks. You exceed the sort of the strength of various materials, either the intruder or the. But I'm not sure we're going to see anything different beyond our fastest impacts. But of course, I don't know. Okay.
Bob, it's a very nice presentation.
I wanted you to say it was a terrible. Never mind. Okay. Okay. Yeah. All right.
Shear experiment back and forth.
Yep.
Can you do some fatigue experiment until the whole thing fracture? Is that possible?
So we do a different version of the system, which I think Karen Dahman might talk a little bit about. But the experiment is specifically made so it doesn't fail, right? So it doesn't get the kind of localized defects where you could develop a shear bend. Okay. So it's this experiment where you give the system a kind of affine kick all the time to keep it from getting localization effects. On the other hand, if we do the pure shear experiment, then we're just pushing from the walls, there's some friction with the bottom, and that definitely breaks, and it breaks every cycle of shear. And so then you can look at avalanching effects and so forth.
I have a quick question on the plot, we call it Hugonian.
I'm sorry, the plot of?
The plot with the wave, the propagation front versus the intruder speed.
Uh-huh. Okay.
You have actually hardening effect.
It does, that's right. That's right.
If and you actually push beyond that, that's something really interesting to
right.
see whether or not you would enter into another regime, a linear regime.
Right. So that goes along with, you know, what would happen if we went faster? Have we really reached the ultimate state? Good question, right? It's that we can probably do, right? We could probably double the impact speed, which is, you know, a factor of 4 in kinetic energy. So we might well be able to push into a, you know, into a regime where, you know, who knows what happens.
So normally we associate the transition from the low speed to the high speed. There's a phase transition, dynamic phase transition, going from the linear, one linear region,
mm-hmm.
you have a hardening
that's right.
region, and you go to another
region. It may well, right? In this case, I mean, we understand, we think, what the hardening is coming about because it will be material dependent, so our particles really have a Poisson ratio that's very close to a half. So when you squish them this way, they go out laterally to the point where they start building up new contacts. And that's the origin of the stiffening. Okay, so we can do a static compression test on a collection of our particles, Okay? And we can see that effect is clearly happening. Okay, so we know the origin of the hardening. Then, are there other hardening mechanisms out there or softening? We don't know, of course, at this point.
Bob?
Oh, yeah, hi.
Could you go to the next slide, please?
Next slide. Okay, yeah.
It wasn't this one. It was the fluctuations.
Okay, yeah, so previous. That one?
Yeah, that one.
Yep.
Could you maybe explain why, but I missed it, why you have such strong fluctuations, are any of these due to boundary effects?
They're all boundary effects. Okay. So the picture that we're proposing here is that you've got this force network, which is the, if you like, the grains that are a little more, that are stiffer. Okay, so you have this system of grains. When you impact it, it's not being compressed homogeneously. It's not a real solid, it's not a molecular solid where you would expect to see more or less homogeneous forcing along the boundary of the intruder. Rather, you have forcing very spatially intermittently around the circumference. And that, of course, is also temporally intermittent for two reasons. One, because you send a pulse down a piece of the chain, okay, but you may re-excite that same chain a little later. And then after some finite time, you rebuild the network, and so you're actually going to hit different areas along the intruder as you plow through. And so that's what you're looking at here, except you have divided out the V-squared part, which is, so as you go slower and slower, the typical force, okay, the typical momentum transfer that you can provide has dropped, okay, but not the fluctuations if you remove that V-squared part. So we're just normalizing out the V-squared part. And then the relevant fluctuations keep going on forever, as long as it's relevant.
Hey, Bob.
Yes.
It's Ken.
Okay, yep.
How's it going?
Good.
Good.
I think.
I have two questions, but one of them is a real easy yes or no question, and the other one I think is a less easy question that is more than yes or no. So the first question is, I think you might have said it, but I didn't quite digest. Did you do a validation just to show that if you look at the luminescence of the particles underneath the intruder to get a sum of forces, that the sum of those forces equals the plus gravity of the object equals mass times acceleration of the object?
Yeah.
You have a good verification that the experimental method is thresholded correctly.
That's okay. The point.
Yeah, so I think you might have said that. So that was the easy question. Second question is, because you have a functional, have you done a variational calculus approach to actually identify the best shape?
Ken.
Anti-defense.
I would love to have a theorist work on this problem.
Because you have a functional, and it looks like it's the standard form to apply the Euler-Lagrange equations, right?
Yeah, you could well indeed. Yeah, it looks just like, you know, the standard problems you give your students to compute, whatever.
Out of the shapes that you tried, which is the one that will penetrate the most?
Pointier. So, you know, the question is...
But it will rotate.
But it will rotate. So, you know, it depends, of course, on what you want to do. But, I mean, if you're trying to get deeper, then you want to... In principle, you want to go pointier, but as Corey says, if it turns, then it will be going flat side down, and so goodness knows, and it won't go straight, you know, deviate.
All right, Bob, very interesting presentation, but I have three comments and maybe questions. Comment number one, when you evaluate velocity of signal propagating in materials,
right.
It's not quite correct to identify just collision between two grains because it's a collective process. Depending on the duration, it can be solitary-like wave or shock-like wave.
Okay.
And there are very good equations. You don't need to look on this, let's say, high school calculations. You can get much better results from the monograph which you cited already.
Okay.
Second one is, if you're serious about shooting, I hope you're not, then you need to look on quite a different regime of loading. And for example, if you look for granular materials like silicon carbide, materials which are commonly used for protection,
right,
then you need to deform them with the strains about 10 power 3, 10 power 4, and displacements much larger than in your experiments. And if you go in this real regime,
right,
with real materials, what you will see instability of granular flow,
right,
which is driven by the fracture of the particles. So the mechanism of shear localization at this regime is microfracture of particles and building
microfracture. Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, if you really went really, really fast, you break stuff.
So if you would like to model this in university environment, then you need to pick up granular materials which are easily fractured at this velocity which you are shooting, and then you will see a new phenomenon of shear instability and building.
Sure. Agreed. Yeah,
and finally, the last comment is that there is other very appropriate test. There is another very appropriate test for pure shear.
Okay.
This is a cylindrical collapse.
Yes.
With explosive, I'm sorry to say, but for this strain rate, you need to use something, let's say, violent.
Yeah, yeah, right.
And in this case, you will see very beautiful picture of shear instability, particle fracture, comminution, dependence on porosity, dependence on particle size, and it's very relevant what you try to do in the next step.
Okay, yes, okay, good.
Okay, Bob, here.
Yeah.
So your experiment here is kind of similar to Eric Brown's experiment, right?
Yeah.
And if I understand Eric's talk, then in his case, the faster you go, the harder it is to penetrate the solution.
Mm-hmm,
but in your case, it seems like it is the opposite. So can you give an intuitive explanation for that?
No, no, it's not true. Actually, the faster you go, the harder it is to penetrate.
Okay.
Okay. So, I mean, if you like, that's the logarithmic increase in the penetration depth, right? So you know, you double your kinetic energy, but you only go log 2 deeper. So it's really getting harder. And then as you start to really compress these systems, in fact, if I'd run that one image or video longer, you'd actually see that the air bounces. So the system has become an elastic solid and then bounces off.
I want to note that Bob Ecke had a nice question about secondary rheology, what happens when you slightly shake from the bottom. And then Mark Robbins wanted to know about how Poncelet changes when you do 3D experiments, but we're out of time. So let's thank Bob for that great talk and all the questions. Chris, let's set you up.